B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, April 4th, 2017. Your humble host generally doesn't cover stories and issues because an event occurred 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or 20 years ago on a specific date. I call that calendar journalism, and I generally avoid it. But today, I do want to honor events that occurred 50 and 49 years ago, respectively. 50 years ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King gave a powerful sermon at the Riverside Church in New York City. 1 year later, precisely to the day, Martin Luther King was gunned down in Memphis, Tennessee. And I'm helping Steve Behrman, a talented individual who's better known as Swami Beyondananda, develop a new podcast. And Steve is a really interesting guy. He works in puns around his character, who is a Swami, and in his gentle and humorous way, really causes us to think. And in his straight character, if you will, Steve Behrman interviewed William Pepper, an attorney, the author of 3 books about the assassination of Dr. King. Pepper represented James Earl Ray, and he later represented King's widow, Coretta Scott King, in a civil suit that exposed, he says, the plot that actually did lead to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And Steve Behrman asked Bill Pepper, who killed King, and how did they get away with it?
You've been maintaining that James Earl Ray was innocent. Who killed King, and how did they get away with it?
Well, the long and the short of it is that the government of the United States, agencies of the United States, killed Martin King. The key agency in the development of the assassination, the plot of the assassination, was the FBI under Hoover. He used Clyde Tolson, his number two, to be the go-between with the Dixie Mafia group in Memphis as they organized the assassination of Martin King. And they got away with it because they controlled all aspects of the investigation, and they had set James up as a patsy. They arranged his escape from prison and used him and developed him throughout the year 1967 and 68 for that purpose.
Later in the interview with Bill Pepper, Steve Behrman asked him about the 1999 civil trial, and here's what Pepper had to say.
It was presented in Memphis, Tennessee, in Shelby County Circuit Court, which was a civil proceeding, and we sued one of the perpetrators, Lloyd Jowers, and we sued Jowers for the purpose of allowing the proceeding to go forward and allowing us to put on all of the evidence that we had at that point in time. It took the jury after 70 witnesses and 30 days of testimony. It took the jury 59 minutes to decide that James Earl Ray was an unwitting patsy, and that the main perpetrators of the crime were the government of the United States and various individuals related to the state of Tennessee and the Memphis Police Department.
Pepper also says that insiders of Dr. King were paid off to assist and, this is the scary part, help the government kill Martin Luther King Jr. Now, the new book by Bill Pepper is called The Plot to Kill King. And based on this interview, I'm going to get a copy of it, and I will line him up for an interview sometime in the future. But I'd like you to hear a passage from Dr. King's sermon at Riverside Church 50 years ago today.
The time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. Now, I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one.
So Dr. King's speech is available on YouTube, and I've put two links in the show file for today's podcast, one to the shorter clip where he's specifically talking about the war in Vietnam and his opposition to it, and the full-length speech, which runs almost an hour, if you have time to take yourself back to that very important moment. And in today's New York Times, David Garrow publishes an opinion piece about that speech. And he edges up to my understanding of the impact of that speech, and that is that Dr. King was rejected by many black Americans, by many political leaders, because it was politically risky to step away from Lyndon Johnson, the president at the time, and to oppose the Vietnam War. And Bill Pepper speculates that that may have been one of the trigger points, one of the reasons that the plot moved forward to remove Dr. King from the American scene. And J. Edgar Hoover ran the infamous COINTELPRO program. And so it's quite consistent, in my view, with what was going on at the time. Meanwhile, the current Attorney General, Jeffrey Beauregard Jim Crow Sessions, has ordered a sweeping review of federal agreements with dozens of law enforcement agencies, starting in Baltimore, where local officials are outraged that Sessions is demanding a delay in the signing of a consent decree that has been carefully negotiated between the police and local parties. Ray Kelly, president of the No Boundaries Coalition in Baltimore, says now we have an outside entity telling us what's best for our citizens and our community when he has no experience and no knowledge. And Jeff Sessions has made it clear that he wants to cut this onerous kind of regulation, kind of like the way Trump talks about, regulation of environmental rules, that kind of thing. And Sessions makes the bizarre rationale that these consent decrees prevent police departments from keeping their communities safe. No, Sessions, what they do is try to rein in the murderous behavior that is often racially tinged by police departments across the country. And we, of course, have Ferguson, Cleveland, Seattle, Chicago, San Francisco. All of these cities have crossed lines. And part of the way of repairing the damage that's been done and trying to rebuild trust between cops and their communities is to make the cops follow the law. And Jeff Sessions wants to make a police badge a license to kill again, to kill with impunity, without any federal oversight or review that can complicate the kind of racist law enforcement that occurs across our country on a daily basis. And if you want evidence, take a look at this blockbuster story at BuzzFeed today. I commend reporter Melissa Segura. The story runs over 40, 45 pages. And she details at least 51 people who were framed for murder by a single Chicago cop named Rinaldo Guevara. And as you may know, I went to Northwestern. I started my radio career in Chicago. I helped expose COINTELPRO and some of the local police corruption. And it was scary to do that, living in an authoritarian town run by the machine Democrat Richard J. Daley I. And I really commend BuzzFeed and Segura for an excellent expose, and I encourage you to read it, because in one case after another, they show how individuals who had credible alibis, who could not have committed the crimes that they were convicted for, were nevertheless found guilty by juries after the testimony of Officer Guevara. City officials have known about this for years, but they say they have zero tolerance for bad cops, and no, this can't possibly be true. But listen to the damage that one man has done. 51 people framed for murders from the 1980s through the early 2000s in the Humboldt Park section of Chicago. 48 men and one woman were sentenced to a total of more than 2,300 years in prison. Three were acquitted. Five received life sentences. Three were sentenced to death but spared by the clearing of death row by Governor George Ryan in 2003. He later went to state prison for other crimes. Not for a death penalty crime, for corruption issues. Two men died behind bars, including Daniel Pena, an illiterate man who testified that Guevara beat him into signing a confession that he couldn't read. And Jeff Sessions doesn't want the Justice Department that he's running to investigate crimes like this. And I maintain that we're never going to get a handle on corrupt law enforcement in this country until good cops will testify against the bad ones. As long as the thin blue line, the blue code, the omerta of police officers is maintained, we will see more Fergusons and more Baltimores and more dead black people in our country. Here's a twisted one. A prosecutor in Brooklyn has pled guilty and will be doing state jail time because she used surveillance tactics to wiretap a colleague and another police officer that she was having an affair with. It was a love triangle. And so Tara Lenich, who was known as an expert in using secret surveillance to take down violent street gangs and drug organizations, well, she used those powers to monitor the phones and activities of her lover and this, I guess, competitor. I don't know all the people here or the players. And we don't know if she used Stingray, but we know that she cut and pasted judges' signatures onto falsified court orders more than 20 times to keep the surveillance going. And this just shows you, all right, the corruption in law enforcement circles and the rationalizations they can make. Well, I've got this power to run down drug dealers, so why not use it on my unfaithful paramour? And as long as we allow the secrecy that pervades the use of these kinds of tactics, people will abuse them. But we just keep going deeper and deeper into that cycle. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Andrew Harnack, George Reeves, Susan Lundgren, and Faith Peoples. They support me with monthly contributions of $5 or $10. And if you've got extra cash and you like what you hear here, why don't you come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then become a subscriber. Pull it down, takes you to the sign-up page, and in minutes you can be set up with your very own subscription. If you're allergic to PayPal, I don't blame you, and we have other options. You can send cash, check, or money order to P.O. Box 100, Mill Valley, California, 94942. That address is listed on the sign-up page as well. I mentioned BuzzFeed a minute ago, and BuzzFeed has a remarkable achievement. One of their reporters, Allie Watkins, has made an interesting connection between Russian spies and a former campaign advisor to Donald Trump. And she did it with actual evidence. Now, this is stunning. This deserves, I don't know, I wish I had a little trumpet flourish or something to play here. But what she did was use court documents. A filing by the U.S. government includes a transcript of a recorded conversation between a Russian intelligence operative whose name is not that complicated, but when Rachel Maddow told the story last night, she just kept substituting the suspect, the defendant, the spy. His name is Viktor Podobny, and Podobny is spelled with double Y's on the end. And this is quite a story, and Rachel told it in her typical style, where she takes a five-minute story and stretches it out for 18 minutes by repeating all the same stuff over and over again. I try to only tell you once. But it turns out that the FBI was able to insert a bug into a binder that the Russians took into a secured room. And we've got these secure rooms at different locations around the U.S. They're called SCIFs, Secured Compartmentalized Something Facility. I can't remember the acronym. At any rate, the bug in the binders led to picking up these conversations, and Podobny talks to Igor Sporyshev, who's another spy, and they're talking about their male number one, a recruit that they're trying to bring over to their dark side, and they appear to succeed in recruiting Carter Page without his knowledge. Now, this was in 2013, and BuzzFeed is honest about that. They're not trying to immediately tie it to the Trump-Russia allegations of the moment. But it is noteworthy that last summer, when candidate Trump was asked, who the hell's advising you on foreign policy, one of the first names he mentioned is Carter Page, and people said, who? What do you get out of that guy? And then he went to Moscow, and as the campaign heated up and Trump secured the nomination, he distanced himself from Carter Page. And Page now gives these bizarre interviews where you really think, is that guy all there? Does the elevator go to the to the penthouse? This is interesting. It doesn't prove anything about Trump. Doesn't prove anything about Trump colluding with the Russians. But it's an interesting article, and it is remarkable because it's actually based on evidence. Unlike, for example, the blockbuster that was published by the Washington Post late yesterday, where they say that Eric Prince, the darling of conservative Washington and neocons, the guy who creates mercenary forces named Blackwater or Z or, gosh, it had different names. He's no longer involved with that organization. He has his own mercenary army based in Hong Kong, called the Frontier Services Group. Eric Prince, you may now know, is the brother of Betsy DeVos. The DeVos family kicked in $10 million to the Trump campaign and bought Betsy the Secretary of Education post. But Eric was too toxic to be included in the administration. He says that he was authorized to be an unofficial envoy for Donald Trump. He went to the Seychelles, islands in the Indian Ocean, for a secret meeting with a man who we don't have an identity for. He's only a Russian who's described as close to Vladimir Putin. All of this story is based on unnamed sources in the U.S., European, and the government of the United Arab Emirates. Now, they do have confirmation that the meeting was brokered by Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who is the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. And he was trying to get the Russians to back off their support for Iran in kind of Gulf politics there. So this, again, is interesting. It occurred in January after we'd already heard about Mike Flynn's contacts with the Russians. So it was pretty secret. And again, all of this, just about all of this, is based on leaks and unnamed sources. Eric Prince issued a statement. This is a complete fabrication. The meeting had nothing to do with Trump. Why is the so-called under-resourced intelligence community messing around with surveillance of American citizens when they should be hunting terrorists? Well, I don't know that the intelligence community exposed this. We actually don't know the origins of the story because it's based on anonymous leaks, and we're not privy to that. So this, you know, is another connect-the-dots story. It is circumstantial evidence. It appears furtive, and we probably deserve answers to this. But again, this is evidence-free, guilt by association, and we're just stuck in the middle of this this firestorm of unsubstantiated claims. Here's the next round. Susan Rice is the latest target of the Trump supporters who want this all to be about leaks, not anything about any, you know, purported relationship with Russian interests in the Trump campaign. And Susan Rice, who was a favorite fall girl for the Republicans during the entire protracted and hyped Benghazi investigation, well, she's now back in the hot seat. And the issue is, did she request unmasking of the American persons, the U.S. persons, who were caught up in wiretaps of Russian officials? And she is very strong in saying all she was doing her job. And while she wasn't asked if she had leaked, she answered on MSNBC today this way. The allegation is that somehow Obama administration officials utilized intelligence for political purposes. That's absolutely false. And then she volunteered, I leaked nothing to nobody and never have and never would. Now, that's interesting because she's denying something that I don't believe has been charged. And I heard Rush Limbaugh chewing this over this morning, and they feel like, you know, it's all Rice here, and this is just a Democratic plot to upset the Trump administration as it's getting going. And maybe there is some truth to that, but they don't have any proof either. And so to trot out Susan Rice with the Benghazi dog whistle, it's just more of the same. As you may know, if you're a regular listener, I have still not been convinced that Russian operatives hacked the Democratic National Committee's computer servers. I am convinced that they didn't have a role in the leaking of the emails of John Podesta, the Clinton campaign boss. But an interesting piece surfaced at the Miami Herald last week under the byline of Glenn Garvin. And he says, who says the hackers were Russian? And he quotes Jeffrey Carr of an international cybersecurity company, which I'll get the name of it for you here. Taiya Global, T-A-I-A, Taiya Global. Jeffrey Carr says, I don't mind blaming the Russians for what they do. I just don't want to blame them for things we don't know that they did. It may turn out they're guilty, but we are very short on evidence here. Thank you, Mr. Carr. He went on to say the FBI never examined the servers that were hacked at the DNC. Instead, they used the private computer security company CrowdStrike to detect and repair the penetrations. All the forensic work on those servers was done by CrowdStrike, and everyone else is relying on information they provided. And CrowdStrike was the one to declare this was the work of the Russians. Well, he echoes comments that I've been making. And I'll just tell you that I'm scheduled to record a new interview with Bill Binney later today. Binney is the former technical director of the National Security Agency, the NSA, and one of my primary and most credible sources for my skepticism about the Russia hacked the DNC and gave that stuff to WikiLeaks claim. And that's the very same claim that's being trotted out as fact by Clint Watts. And I don't know if you've seen this guy. He's a G-man, looks like it. Ex-FBI agent and national security expert. And he was trotted out last week for the Senate Intelligence Committee hearings. And I'm highly suspicious of this guy, and I just want to share that with you and urge you to be skeptical of the things that he's saying. He told Vice News that if you look at Trump's Twitter feed this morning, he cited a WikiLeaks release, essentially, which was conducted by the Russians to attack Hillary Clinton yet again, even after the election. Watts said Russia stole information, Trump is still using it against his opponent, and he already won the election, so he's giving Russia a victory even after the election, and they were already winning before. Now, this is linked to a longer video interview, and you can find that at Vice News if you're so inclined. But I find this guy to be really unreliable, and the thundering conclusions that he draws here, that, you know, it's just a fact that Russia hacked, WikiLeaks got it, then WikiLeaks became a tool of the Russian government. Therefore, anything that comes from WikiLeaks, he imputes to the Russians. And it's fair to say that Trump hasn't let go of the election and still wants to ding Hillary Clinton. And he may be using some Russian memes or talking points in that effort. but that is no way conclusive of the kind of conclusion that is drawn by Mr. Watts in this little outburst. Yesterday, I led the News and Comment podcast with rare agreement between me and the Trumpster over the policy in Syria. And I've called it incoherent because Obama kept claiming that we could take down the Islamic State and the Assad government all at the same time and everything would be fabulous. You know, just open up a Disney theme park in Syria, right? Well, this has been complicated now because Syria is now accused, the government, of the deadliest chemical weapons attack in years in Idlib province earlier today. They're saying that scores of people were injured, sickened, and they were responding not to what has become kind of commonplace, the use of chlorine, but it's believed that nerve agents were likely also involved, or maybe they were the sole agent there. This is a serious allegation. Interestingly, the White House blames it on Obama. Sean Spicer saying, "These heinous acts by the Assad regime are a consequence of the last administration's weakness and irresolution." Now, even I call bullshit on that, and I've been sharply critical of Obama's policies regarding Syria. Now, here's where things get weird. Rescue workers from the White Helmet Civil Defense Organization appear to be the primary source that there are 50 dead and 250 wounded. Important questions have been raised about the authenticity of the White Helmets and their possible ties to American intelligence agencies. I don't have proof. I have doubts. And so we have to be skeptical here. In addition, the Syrian government offers this excuse, which could be plausible. They're saying there are two different sources citing government information in Syria who say that the Syrian military bombed a weapons factory belonging to insurgents. They name al-Qaeda-linked militants who had a bomb factory, and that it was raided, given an airstrike by the Syrians, near the town of Khan Sheikhoun. Now, none of us is there. We don't have a way of figuring out if the government's telling the truth or if our government is telling the truth. But, as always, I approach these reports with skepticism. Back here in the States, Mike Pence, who was the governor of Indiana before being plucked to be the vice president, he was violently against abortion. And he used every opportunity. He was the first to defund Planned Parenthood. And he signed a law requiring a woman seeking an abortion to get an ultrasound at least 18 hours before the abortion. And a federal judge has struck that law down, saying that the state failed to provide any convincing evidence that the law does preserve fetal life and women's mental health. And the judge was pretty strong. The law burdens people. It creates the burdens. The burdens it creates on women seeking to terminate their pregnancies dramatically outweigh the benefits, making the burdens undue in the new ultrasound law likely unconstitutional. And yesterday we talked about the new Arkansas bill that would ban abortion if it is used for sex selection, which is just a very bizarre area to imagine that you can enforce legal penalties on people who make a decision on that basis. I want to recommend that you read Glenn Greenwald's piece published yesterday, because it echoes a lot of what I had to say about Donald Trump inviting the Egyptian military dictator al-Sisi to the White House. And I pointed out that the Obama administration, while it pretended to punish Egypt over human rights and related issues, in fact, the policy that Trump is showing is consistent with the Obama policy, except that he doesn't pretend to try to punish Egypt over its human rights policies, the draconian crackdown on dissent and members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And Greenwald takes swipes at Paul Krugman along the way, well-deserved, and I encourage you to read the piece. Also at The Intercept, Lee Fung, who's a great investigative journalist, he dug into the financial disclosure documents that were dumped last Friday by the White House, and in particular those related to Scott Gottlieb. He is set to appear tomorrow for a confirmation hearing at the Senate committee. And Fung exposes that Gottlieb has carried a lot of water for the opioid industry in this country. He got $45,000 in speaking fees, but he also has been very aggressive in attacking the FDA, which he seeks to lead, for its enforcement of rules against opioid manufacturers. And so, for example, Mallinckrodt Pharmaceuticals paid Gottlieb $22,000 for a speech, and Mallinckrodt reached a tentative settlement this week, agreeing to pay $35 million for suspicious orders in Florida for its oxycodone products. And they reportedly shipped 780 million prescription pills to pharmacies in West Virginia alone. And you may have heard that OxyContin is referred to as hillbilly heroin. That is plenty of heroin for all the hillbillies in West Virginia. And when the FDA cracked down on this, I'm sorry, the DEA in this case, Gottlieb wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal condemning it. Will this stop the Republicans from confirming him? Will this lead Democrats to oppose him? Well, I sure hope so, but I don't have a lot of confidence. Trump signed into law today the resolutions that complete the evisceration of the modest internet privacy protections that were created by the Obama Federal Communications Commission. This will allow broadband internet service suppliers to track and sell your online information, to serve ads based on your internet searching record, like Google and Facebook do, only you're not required to use Google or Facebook just to get on the internet, but you need a phone company or an internet service provider just to be able to access the internet in general. So this is a very, very dire development, and we will pay a price for it. One of the beneficiaries of this is Verizon, and Verizon is buying Yahoo. They already bought AOL. So they're getting these old internet companies, and they're going to put them under one brand name. And apparently Verizon did this because they wanted to be able to serve ads by searching your browsing history on AOL and Yahoo. Now, here's the dumbest thing I've heard in a long time. Verizon has announced today that the new holding company for its internet assets, including Yahoo, AOL, and the Huffington Post, is going to be called Oath. Yeah. I know you're saying, what? What the hell's Oath? O-A-T-H. I guess Oats was already taken by Quaker. I don't know. And the Wags of Silicon Valley are already on the case. Oath, Trunk, that was the corporate name for the Chicago Tribune, and New Coke. Here in California, a new study shows that giving driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants has reduced hit-and-run traffic accidents by a measurable degree, at least 7%, and it has lowered insurance premiums for all Californians by $17 million a year. I once had a fender bender with a man who confessed to me that he didn't have citizenship papers or a driver's license. He did about $1,000, maybe $1,500 in damage to my car. And he said, if you don't report this to the police, I will pay you, I promise. And he did. And I didn't. And finally, today I want to say a fond farewell to my old friend Dick Bowles. He was the author of umpteen editions of What Color Is Your Parachute, the most popular job hunting manual, I think, in American history. Dick Bowles came on my radio show in San Francisco dozens of times. We got to be pals. We had lunch a few times. I found him a really charming guy. He had been an Episcopalian minister. He was a scientist of some kind, a physics major. And I thought I knew a lot about Dick Bowles, but from his obituary, I learned that he was the younger brother of Don Bowles, the Phoenix, newspaper reporter, who was killed when a bomb detonated under his car back in 1976. In all our conversations, Dick Bowles never told me that Don Bowles was his brother and died in that very tragic and ugly incident. Thanks for joining me for my News and Comment podcast today. As always, it's free and it's available on YouTube. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.